Hello everyone, this is Abhivardhan from IndusThink and obviously the Bharat Pacific. After a long time, we are back with our Glocalized Spaces. This is one of the Bharat Pacific roundups as a part of the Glocalized series. We have been discussing foreign policy and other things. We have also discussed the Data Protection Act in August. And now we thought, you know what, semiconductors are becoming an important part of discussion. It has always been, but you know, as we see the updates in Dholera and other places in the country, I think semiconductors is something which is worth discussing. And for that, we have some amazing people with us, with obviously the great Aditya Jakki. So Aditya and I are hosting it, but this is Aditya's show, obviously. So we have Satvik and Arun. Both of them are respected in their own fields. Arun is known for discussing and contributing to aspects related to India's semiconductor discourse on crucial issues. And you can follow him on Twitter at the rate @nano_Arun. His insights on India's semiconductor journey are worthwhile. His interesting discussion with Arihant, you know, one of the best podcasters in India, Vaad, was actually one of the best discussions on semiconductors. So, you know, I guess you should watch it. And even his interactions in other places. So, and Satvik is a student in international relations and related aspects. So I must thank Satvik that, you know, he prompted us on Twitter to have this discussion. X, basically. So we are live on X, which is to say YouTube and this one, Twitter. So I hope this discussion will be enjoyable and great. So Aditya, I think we should begin. What do you think?
Yeah, and I think you forgot to add in your description of Arun, quite brutal and honest. So
yeah, I should have. But yeah.
No pampering, no sugarcoating.
No sugarcoating. And that's great to do, you know. That's yeah. A great thing.
So before we get into specifics and everything, Arun, maybe I will start with the basic of the basic questions. Can you explain in like few minutes to our listeners or viewers why semiconductor is important and why they should care? And as a follow-up to that, how does the basic semiconductor manufacturing process actually occur from the designing stage to actually the when it enters to the market? So these two questions, please, Arun.
Right. So thanks everyone, first of all, and apologies for not coming on the video, being kind of quite tired after a hot day here out in Kerala. So to answer the first question, in fact, for somebody like me, what is surprising is not the fact that India is hopefully finally getting a fab after 50-60 years, but the fact that India did not have a fab for a commercial fab for 50-60 years, because the semiconductors or the chips made out of semiconductors or other components made out of semiconductors is one of the things that revolutionized the entire electronics world for a century. And the fact that we did not have a facility in India making it all these while, that we almost were completely unaware of this entire field, except for a few people who might have worked in some facilities like SCL Mohali or in academia, or of course those who have gone abroad for doing their higher studies or working for some of these companies outside. But within the Indian geography, this field was completely ignored or almost completely ignored for 5 to 6 decades is the surprising fact, because anything that you take, I mean, you said I am known to be brutal. So I'll start off with the brutality in terms of, let's say, what Minister Ashwini Vaishnav actually said on that day when the Dholera groundbreaking was happening. He said anything that turns on and off has semiconductors in it. That was a little too far-fetched. Not everything that turns on and off has semiconductors in it. Obviously, your good old filament bulb turns on and off does not have semiconductor in it. But anything electronics has semiconductor in it, or a semiconductor based chip or component or something in it, and so naturally it is such an important thing that India should have had. I mean, it's if let's say rice is a staple diet for the people of India, semiconductors is a staple diet for anything electronics, right? So we were missing out on that for this entire 5 or 6 decades. So this is the bottom line of it. Now, before I get into how exactly these are made, I'll just mention a couple of sentences. As a country, it is our choice, and it is still our choice, if we, let's say, go by the Raghuram Rajan advisory of let us still not bother to make them in India, let us still keep importing them in India, let us still focus only on service level jobs and so on and so forth. But obviously, that is something that I cannot agree with personally, and I hope a lot of Indians have come to realize that that's not going to help us sustain for a long time. Service level jobs, already you've seen, started seeing decline in the IT jobs, so many, so much layoffs and so on and so forth. And more important than that, strategically, it is always going to keep India as a slave. Literally, you know, from until 47, if you were slave from a political perspective, for right now, from a technology perspective, if you don't have the basic ability to make the semiconductor chips and the further electronics in India, you continue to remain a slave to whoever makes it. As simple as that. Now, it is now we have chosen, the government has chosen, it has bitten the bullet, decided that let us have semiconductor manufacturing in India. And so we are there, and hopefully we have made a beginning there. The process of manufacturing the semiconductor chips and what happens from the design and so on, I'll try to explain in an as simple a way as possible. So just like anything else,
let's sorry to interject. That is what we also need, simple basically.
So let us take the example of making a house itself, right? Where do you start? So you start with first putting down how many bedrooms do you want, how many floors do you want, for example, is it a single-storied building or a two-storied building, and then you come up with a plan, right? A floor plan, and then you find out your architects or find out your, you know, the people who actually build it, your contractors. So somewhat of a similar fashion where you first decide what exactly is it that you want. What are the specifications of the chip that you want? Is it a general purpose chip where you sort of program it and then make it to do something? Or is it a very, very specific chip? For example, what you often hear as the ASICs, right? So application specific chip. Does it need to have a little bit more power to do, let us say, graphic processing compared to something else? Should it be a very artificial intelligence specific chip, or general plain vanilla chip? So all of these is what you first start to think and decide. I mean, of course, I'm not talking about a person deciding it. I'm talking about various companies, right? Certain companies will focus on GPUs, certain will focus on CPUs, certain will focus on communication related chips, and so on and so forth. Now, once you have that, well, really, from an engineering student perspective, or speaking of his language, you first convert this architectural sort of a diagram into, really speaking, a circuit level diagram. If you've gone through your basic first year or second year engineering, no matter in which field you are, I'm sure you would have seen some circuits with transistors or resistors and capacitors and so on, mostly transistors. So these ones are but then in this particular case, you are talking about, depending on the complexity of the chip, you're talking about anywhere between tens of thousands of transistors to lakhs to millions to billions, right? So this is what is a circuit level design. If you talk to semiconductor design engineers, again, this, I'm still talking about the circuit level. For example, our Minister of State, Rajiv Chandrasekhar, the 3 years or so he spent in Intel, he most likely worked at that circuit level where you talk about netlist and this and that, where you're essentially checking for all the functionalities, whether your process, your number of gates, your registers, memory, all of that are as per the specification and so on and so forth. Now this is still, all said and done, an on-paper diagram. From that circuit level, you have to take it into what is called as a physical design, or sometimes called as a layout design, which is basically how the circuitry is all going to be eventually made on silicon. It is still a diagram, it is still a plan, it is still a design, right? But from converting that circuit level into a physical design. And there, again, you have various steps there. And of course, most of this is automated, most of this is all standard stuff you use. So this is where, if you talk about supply chain, this is where some of these EDA vendors or the design automation folks like Cadence and Synopsys and all of those come in. Their tools help in all of these process steps, various steps. And then from there, that is when you have. Now, let's take just a simple example. If you're talking about, let's say, a 22 nanometer or 28 nanometer chip, you probably have 60 to 70 to 80 levels that you need to process on a silicon wafer. By level, I'll just give you another simple example to try to make it, make it clearer. So imagine you seeing an integrated circuit and IC, you finally have a black thing with maybe like 30 or 40 pins, right? Now you're basically connecting your billions of transistors down there to finally 40 or 50 or something like that pins. So how do you make these connections? You obviously need multiple metal layers, multiple wiring levels where you connect these billions of transistors to this finally a few number of pins. So all of these levels, and between what you call as metal 1, metal 2, metal 3, metal 4, and between, to connect from metal 1 to metal 2, you need vias and so on. So these are all what I call as levels. So like this, and this is just on the, taking the connection part. Likewise, below the transistor also, inside the various transistor level, geographies, you have various areas where you do different kinds of doping, implantation, so that different transistors behave differently and so on and so forth. I'm not getting into the details, hopefully, but so these all make it, 50 or 60 or 70 or 80 levels that you need to process in silicon wafers. And these are all part of the physical design. They're all together in the physical design. Now, this particular whole set of 50, 60 layers is what is sent into a fab. Now, once it comes to the fab, these layers are separated out. They need to do some, there are some things that are done on these designs so as to make them print properly and so on and so forth. And then it goes through the whole automated process in the fab where all of these levels are printed on the silicon. After printing them, they go through sometimes etching, sometimes sometimes deposition, so on and so forth. So this whole package of steps that happen in the fab, that's what we often call as the fab technology, or if you want to call it the fab IP, and so on and so forth. And a lot of this is automated, but as I said, these are tens and thousands of steps, and you need to have precision in all of these steps, and you need to do this in a large scale where you don't have any failures, or you have very little failures. So this is what happens in the fab. And once these chips are fabricated on the wafer, then they are cut into, so multiple chips are fabricated on a single wafer, and then they are cut, tested, and packaged into those black cases. So that testing and packaging historically used to be together with the fabs, but with time, that cutting and packaging and testing, all of that started getting outsourced. That is the OSAT. And now you have the OSATs also coming up in various geographies. And once it's packaged, obviously it's sold. Again, within the fab also, there are two models where some of them do it as contract basis for design companies, whereas somebody like Intel does both its own chips also, and it also these days do it for the other. So let me stop right there. This is kind of the high level picture of the whole supply chain, but if there are specific questions, I'll be glad to go into more detail.
Yeah, now that we are done with the basic part, like why is it important and what it takes to actually go through the whole process of manufacturing a semiconductor chip. Now, I think let this session be divided into three parts. First would be like what is the status of Indian semiconductor industry at the moment? What is the policy level and what is the actual industrial practical on field and on ground level of our industry, basically, in terms of the policy. Second would be then what is the global industrial level, and the third would be the strategic picture, which would be like what are the strategic games and etc. So Satvik and Abhivardhan, do you want to start with the domestic Indian policy, your questions or comments?
I'll take one point of Satvik, which I think I found interesting. Now, Arun mentioned about the evolution of the journey so far, how packaging and other things changed and you know how OSATs have come up, and that's great. So I think Satvik mentioned, and you know, kind of read about it. There was a report on India semiconductor readiness. So I'm pretty sure that somebody who's not in tech policy or industrial tech policy per se will not be able to understand the purpose of the report from an Indian perspective. To why does it matter? But in case you have read, the question to Arun, like, if in case you have gone through the report, what do you think about India's semiconductor readiness? What's your view?
So I'm not sure exactly which report you're referring to, but I might not have seen it. That's okay. I still get the question. So, see, in terms of readiness, obviously, starting off that we were decades late, right? So better late than never. Now, good or bad, the Indian way many times is very, very reactionary. In other words, you put yourself into a situation where you're already almost neck deep in water, and that's when you start learning to swim. So that's but then probably we Indians excel at that. I mean, look at the way COVID situation was handled, right? Initially there were concerns of how prepared we are and vaccines and so on and so forth. But then we did handle it reasonably well eventually. So likewise in semiconductors also, I think we are going to make our mistakes, or you know, it's not going to be an easy journey. Definitely there are going to be a little bit of falls, and then you get up and you know, try again. Now, is that affordable or not? That's a different question altogether. Obviously, there is some bit of cushion that you have in certain things, but in certain things you cannot make mistake. But let's see how that comes up. Now, what is a little bit now again, if you compare some of the other countries, I'll just give an example. I don't mean to generalize it, but just as an example. When some of the fabs came up in upstate New York, before even putting the first shovel on the ground, they had done so much of studies in terms of environmental impact, social impact. There are thousands and thousands of pages of document, and these are all done even at a county level, not even at a state level, right? The particular county in which this was supposed to come, they have done extensive studies, then discussed with the state, so on and so forth. Now, if you look at the Indian scenario, really speaking, and you know, even now, there is still no proper document as far as I can see in terms of, you know, what is it that is promised by the company which is putting up in terms of the environmental impact and so on, right? We still don't have it. I don't still see it.
One thing to interject is that when I talked to one of the people who were writing this report, is that they talked to a lot of these semiconductor companies, and they said that they consider over 500 different factors when it comes to local semiconductor fab production, even including local gravity. It gets to that level of minutia.
Yes. And I know none of these were that detailedly studied or documented, but still we are taking off, right? And that's where I say that, you know, the Indian way many times is where you kind of learn these along the way, or, you know, struggle through this along the way. That's how it is going to be. I mean, and that is part of the reason why you have a 50% to 70%, 50% from the central government and 20% from the state government incentives, because in fact, if you read the policy, if you read the document which actually put up the policy with the incentives, it actually admits that India doesn't have many of these infrastructural elements and the preparedness, and that is why these incentives are given, right? Now, having said that, I haven't visited, for example, Dholera or Sanand or any of those places. But what I feel is that some of these things, I probably you're going to come to that in a little later. But what the government also should try to avoid is this unnecessary pressure. For example, again, the brutal man that I am, the minister should not be, you know, keeping on making statements that the first Made in India chip is going to come out in December of 2024 and things like that. First of all, that Made in India hardly makes any real sense, because if he means the Micron facility, it is only packaging the chip. It's not really fabricating the chip. And if you are talking about, if you are claiming packaging the chip as Made in India chip, then anyway, there are other companies which claim, Sahasra Semiconductors, for example, which claim to be doing it. Now, what happens is that these kind of statements puts the company in undue pressure. And even for that matter, the Tata PSMC fab that is going to come up in Dholera, 2026 is what the date is being given. Again, it's pressure. I mean, I'll be the happiest person if that happens, it actually comes out. But, there's one person whom I spoke to sort of from inside the company that is trying to do it, though he's not exactly related to this project. And he was mentioning worries of, I don't know how we're going to do it. So that, you know, should not happen. At the same time, you know, the government has to be supportive. It has to facilitate these things, avoid all these delays in whatever it is. Let the company go through it and let them figure it out. At the same time, do not create roadblocks and things like that. But beyond that, don't give these pressurizing kind of deadlines and things like that. But then, going back to the essence of your question, are we ready? If I can almost tell you, if any country which is currently known to be good with semiconductors, Taiwanese or Americans or even Singaporeans or any of them, come and see, oh, what have you done as a groundwork to make sure that this project is going to be successful, I'm pretty sure most of them are going to be disappointed. And that is exactly why not too many people came also, right? But having said that, they don't know the Indian way, right? We learn it the hard way. So I'm eventually confident that it'll happen. But how much of collateral damage will be there in the process? We'll have to wait and see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just for clarification, I have to mention what he means by Indian way. Indian way is usually when it comes to day-to-day due diligence, we are quite not up to the mark. Of course, there are state capacity issues, resource constraints, etc. But however, when it becomes a mission mode or like a single point-oriented project, something like that, for a state or a prestige issue for the state, then somehow state comes together and fixes loopholes, jugaad, and somehow makes it work. I don't think it works always, but it does work. It has certainly worked in some of the critical moments of our history. So, but I don't know how reliable that can be always, as Arun has said. Yeah. So, in short.
But yeah, so and to add, before Satvi comes, I'll just be very quick. I think, as Arun rightly said, the Indian way, and I don't think this relates to the Ministry of External Affairs India way, that's different. I'll keep that at the intersection. But I think the problem is in industrial policy, it's very strange, right? Even in DevTech, I think I keep discussing with Krishnan on X, this is Twitter, very confusing names. And he says that in one department in defense technology, somebody is doing wonders. In another department, it's just getting delayed and nothing is happening. Even in railways, this is the thing, you know, even in the AI mission, like, you know, two different ministries, different approaches. I don't wish to talk about the AI advisory. And again, then we have the AI mission, whose funds have been disclosed by the Ministry of Commerce. And I think it's a good plan. On other hand, we have a digital competition bill. So I don't know. I mean, it's a thing of proportions. It happens in, that's why it does not have a sense of harmony. And I think it will take time how we get there. So yeah, I think, Satvik, please.
So I'd like to begin by just setting a framing. So a couple of years ago, so Japan got their TSMC plant approved by the government and by TSMC. And within a year, slightly over a year, they are ready to begin. And that required the great coordination between the local government, construction companies, the TSMC, and all kinds of private industry. This was a very concerted government, and Japan's highly efficient state bureaucracy is able to do this. India is not in this, not even in the same league as Japan when it comes to this. We have a highly inefficient state bureaucracy. Our resource capacity is quite mixed. Semiconductors really need ultra pure water, rare gases, constant delivery of electricity. A lot of these states in India do not have such things. But we have seen a lot of these semiconductor plants choose Gujarat as a main hub. Is this, in your opinion, Arun, is this something that is mainly due to the government's push of a policy push, or has there been actual work on the ground to improve the resource inputs and the different kinds of requirements that a fab would really need? And if not, what really needs to be done?
Yeah, so this question has often come up, and as I keep saying, I admit I haven't visited Dholera or any of those places. I've, in fact, probably not been to Gujarat itself, but hopefully one day. Anyway, so two, three reasons is what I feel. One, of course, there's been an official statement by the minister, by Ashwini Vaishnav, saying that the chemical industry that is there in Dahej area is one of the main reasons why the semiconductor plants are coming up in Gujarat. Well, I take it a little bit. I give him the trust. I mean, I trust him on that, but that cannot be the only reason. Transportation from elsewhere is also not a big deal. But then I take it as two, three other reasons also. One, of course, political stability, as in the same government continuing. So there's no worry of the state level policy being discontinued or anything. I mean, take the case of Karnataka, for example, right? Though the ISMC did not work out for other reasons, but the Karnataka government, the previous government had promised 25% incentives in the land in Mysore and so on and so forth. Now, the current government, they're not even talking about it. Of course, the fact is that proposal is probably no more valid even, but does the government, if there is another valid proposal, or for that matter, the existing tower proposal itself, if they still choose Karnataka or Mysore, is the current Karnataka government willing to give the 20-25% incentive? I doubt it, right? I mean, they've given so many freebies, they probably don't even have the money. So that worry is not there in Gujarat, at least for the next 5 years, maybe 10 years. Secondly, at least some people who visited, what they've told me is that some of the facilities, for example, you know, we keep talking about water. First of all, no fab directly gets ultra pure water. I mean, whatever water resources available, they take it and they pure. I mean, it's not even, the technical term is not even purify, it's deionization. So you get deionized water. There are deionization plants that every fab will have. Apparently, if any of you have visited, obviously you can correct me or add on to what I'm saying, but they have diverted the river and they have created this artificial canal sort of a thing which goes into Dholera. I think they're promising about 150 MLD, right, million liters per day of water in that whole facility. Out of which the fab might need somewhere between 10 or 20 or maximum 30 if it is running in full capacity. So yes, once the fab is up and running, that is going to be the one of the main users of the water facility there, but it's still within what the facility is actually promising. Whether they are already reached that promised amount or not, I don't know, but at least the canal is there. There are videos out there on YouTube which shows the canal and so on with the water flowing in. So now compare that with, again, I go back to the Mysore example, right? So all the promises were all there, and there was even announcement saying that Mysore land was chosen. Now this water has to come from the Karas Dam, Krishnarajasagar Dam. But there was absolutely no talk on how exactly that is going to be achieved. Are you going to put dedicated pipelines for that? Nothing. So how will you be confident? Compare that with the Dholera, where already at least the canal is there. You probably just need to connect from the canal to your facility, and then of course deionize the water and so on and so forth. So likewise, there are also other common facilities, chemical treatment plants, wastewater treatment plants, which are all common facilities in Dolera, as far as I can see. Even on their website, they mention all of this. So this way, at least in the beginning, right? I mean, eventually the FAB may need some of these facilities captive for them, because the amount of water being processed and amount of chemicals being processed might be huge, might not fit for the common facilitation center. But at least to begin with, you can always use these common facilitation center, right? Get up and running. So these are all the facilities which I think probably has made Dolera a much better choice. But having said that, whether that facility is also 100% ready, probably not. But you still have 2 or 3 years before a fab, the actual building of the fab will be built. So hopefully they'll address some of this, right?
Mm-hmm. Right. So to add some context to the discussion, and you know, take it a little bit from a sectoral point of view, I mean, you're absolutely right. If you have a specific industry use case, you will use a specific kind of semiconductors, right? For example, if you have to build a generative AI product or service, which is like you require a lot of GPUs, right? Because there are billion parameters and whatnot. And that's what, because I know, because I'm in the AI space, so I understand this. But when we look at strategic considerations before we get into China or Taiwan, or maybe there are a few things which might be left, I have two questions. The first one is a little bit about certain other places where the potential could be tapped in. One obviously is that Assam and Gujarat are in the pipeline, and on the Karnataka government, you rightly mentioned that they have a funding crunch thanks to their freebies and whatsoever they have. Dolera, as you said, it's still a work in progress, and I agree. How's the thing going for West Uttar Pradesh per se, Delhi NCR, or those places? Is there any scope? Maybe you can answer this one, then I'll ask you the second question.
Just to add to that, Arun, if you don't mind, just to add to that, can you also explain what's the difference between the recent spate of announcement, that the three announcements that were made, and the earlier Vedanta Foxconn adventure, which turned out to be a big disaster? So what is the clear difference? So what went wrong with the Vedanta, and why did the recent one turned out to be pretty satisfactory, if not like a completely blockbuster thing? But
yeah, I'll answer both. So Uttar Pradesh, honestly, I don't know why the government, the UP government probably didn't push too much. There were some of the followers that I have on Twitter who are from UP, they were quite hopeful that, okay, you are one of them. So hopeful that especially some defense corridor or something is there, right, across along that the river banks and so on. So eventually something will come up there, and nothing happened. Now I really don't know what didn't click, but I believe that there are other kind of last mile businesses, like even the display, Samsung's display units and things like that, which are probably coming up there. The fab itself, why it didn't really happen there, not sure yet. Again, I haven't examined in details. And also maybe UP was a little bit late in terms of coming up with some semiconductor policy also, if I remember it right. I could be wrong, but if I vaguely remember that Gujarat was much earlier in terms of its policy. But in any case, again, it's not yet a closed chapter, right? I mean, look, there is also this whole discussion of, should you cluster them? Let's say there are multiple fabs coming up in India over the next 5 to 10 years. Should you cluster them all in one place, or should you diversify? You can argue from both sides. Clustering has its advantages. At the same time, they have its disadvantages, right? I mean, one particular state goes into a little bit of water crunch or possible problems, the whole thing is stuck. So that's the advantage of diversifying. And on top of that, and also in terms of the amount of money that the state has to put in, right? I mean, imagine this. Right now, already Gujarat is funding 20% of Tata PSMC fab, another 20% of Micron ATMP. I mean, how many more are you talking about, right? Do they have the money for another 3 or 4, just to give the subsidies? Maybe, start diversifying into some other state. So that's the other argument. So you know, these things, we had to wait and see how these play out for UP or for you know, for other things. Assam, it was a good choice because, again, from the perspective of diversification as well as Northeast being given due importance. So hopefully that will take off good.
Now, yeah, coming one state that I heard. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Sure. One state that I heard was that a lot of people are overlooking is Odisha. Odisha has been actually doing some really interesting things when it comes to their power grid and their water and their water infrastructure that a lot of companies should be looking into.
Yeah, and the same argument of Dahej having chemical industry was pointed out by somebody saying if that's the argument, then Odisha should also gain from their ports and, you know, nearity to the ports and things like that. So let's see. Hopefully, we'll see some things come up there also in the near future. Now, the second part of it, Vedanta Foxconn, see, the fundamental issue or the point here is that the policy also, the government of India's policy also demands that whoever is applying for the incentive should either be directly experienced running a fab of that particular technology that you're applying for, or you should have a partner, or in the least, you should have a production grade license from somebody who is doing this in large scale, the same technology large scale elsewhere. And Vedanta Foxconn simply didn't have it. The unfortunate part was that it took like this 2 years or almost, you know, 1.5 years of back and forth. First Vedanta claiming that Foxconn has the technology, and then obviously turning out that, or, you know, people like us pointing out that no, Foxconn doesn't have it. Foxconn is a different kind of company. Whatever little fabs they have is a completely different type of you know, fabs. And then my own understanding is that the government lost a lot of time in arguing whether our research and development kind of facility like IMEC can provide the technology. Can that be counted as a production grade license? I mean, this is the funny part, right? In the policy, you put that you need to have production grade license, but then you don't yourself know what exactly is a production grade license mean, right? And you lose 6 months, 7 months arguing within yourself whether this qualifies or that qualifies. So this is, and all this while, maybe the government was also giving Vedanta a long rope that you go and talk to companies like ST Micro. I mean, for so many days, it was in the news that Vedanta is getting technology from ST Micro Electronics, this, that, and nothing happened. So bottom line was that they didn't have that license. They didn't have the production grade license. When India is, see, the technical aspect of this is as simple as this. When you're trying to go into 28 nanometer or something, or even 40-60 nanometers, these are technologies that are developed over multiple generations. Though you call 28 or 40 or 65 as quote unquote mature node or older generation, this is newer to many, you know, 5 or 6 or 8 or 10 generations behind you. And you can't directly jump into a 45 or 65. You can't do this from scratch in a high volume. You're going to lose a lot of money reinventing the wheel. So to begin with, you basically get, you know, copy and paste something which is already running in a high volume fab elsewhere. And that is the right strategy also. And then once you have a base technology, whether it's 65 or 45 or 28 or whatever, and then you can build upon it in the next 2 years, 3 years, you can move on to the next node and so on, provided there's money for you to do that transition, right? So when you have this, the first fundamental base one that you transfer should be such that after the go from the starting point of the so-called technology transfer, within the 6 months or maximum within 1 year, the fab should be up and running and making chips in production. If you start doing this from scratch, you're going to get 3 years, 5 years, 6 years with no guarantee of it succeeding. So this was the fundamental idea. And even if you transfer from the so-called R&D fabs and so on and so forth, they don't have production grade technologies. They don't even have the whole stack. So that is what made the Vedanta Foxconn a failure. And then even now, both Vedanta and Foxconn have separately applied. But if they don't have a production grade license or a technology partner, it's not going to go anywhere. For whatever reason, the government of India, the mighty, doesn't reject any of this. They just keep sitting on it, probably thinking that you yourself get fed up with this and you withdraw your application, well and good. We are not going to reject you. That's as simple as that.
Yeah, quite interesting. So the second question which I was going to ask, and I think that can lead us to a little bit about strategic considerations to start with, because you pointed out something important.
Before going there, Abhivardhan, so you are going into strategic there, unless Satvik also wants to be going into that direction. I have one final point within this scope.
Sure.
Basically, Arun, one, how reliable is the government's assurance that we are actually going to do 28 nanometer thing in the current round of announcement? And two, in relation to that, I have heard, I think it's Pranay Kothasthane, or I am not sure if someone else at the
money,
moment.
The money is...
The amount of subsidies India is giving is proportionally way higher than the other countries are giving for the same level of work, is what I heard. Is it true?
Right. Yeah. So I'll quickly answer both. So this is, you know, probably this is one exception where you can probably accuse me of deviating a little bit from that brutality and being a little soft on Tata PSMC proposal, because you know, for somebody like me having waited for so long, I was like, okay, chalta hai here and there, it's not a, you know, 100% what they claim, but chalta hai. So 28 nanometer, so you know, really speaking, no, they don't have it yet. Okay, Powerchip, if on their own website, the technology partner is Powerchip, on their own website, 28 nanometer, they have it in production for DRAM and NAND. They don't have it, it's still in development for logic and you know, other kind of chips. Now, having said that, the hope is that I believe they're also doing a fab in Japan, together with some SBI, it's not our State Bank of India, some other SBI holding company or something in Japan. This news came almost 6 months back. After that, I haven't seen much of the news on it, but I hope, you know, they are doing it, whichever way. The hope is that by the time, the factory comes up in India in 2 years, Powerchip will have it in production for 28 nanometer also. That's what I understand from their whole wordings and so on and so forth. But then to me, you know, beyond a point, it's not that important, because definitely 40s and 50s and 60s they have in production. So even if India gets that, and even if we start making chips with that in the next 3 or 4 years, it's still a good beginning. And then we can always build up to the 28. Just to you know, add to that, it's not easy, as in, to even this copy and paste that I spoke about, or moving to 28 and all, Tata as well as Powerchip, both of them have to work extremely good, extremely well together, with sufficient support from the government. Again, long story, so I don't want to get into all the details, but there are nitty-gritties and you don't want a failure. I really hope that both the companies, as well as on the government side, there is very good import, you know, attention given to how this project is all coming up, and it takes off. Sorry, what was the other? Yeah, so the cost of it. Yeah, so the cost of it, see, the 2 years, 3 years before, when I used to write, my estimate for a 28 nanometer fab of about 40,000 wafer per month capacity was somewhere around $8 billion. Now this one is, first of all, it says 50,000 capacity, so right away, straight away, almost 25% more. So the 8 becomes 10, right, in that sense, almost. It's not a linear calculation, but still more or less 10 billion. And then from the time I wrote my articles and I wrote my estimates, the equipment cost did go up. So you give them all of that, and one more factor is that we still have no clue how much is Powerchip charging for the technology. So as of now, the news that has come out is that Powerchip is not taking a stake. They're only giving the technology. So the license fee, right, for the technology, it could be in billions. It could be easily 1 billion. I mean, I would be surprised if the license fee is anything less than 1 billion. That will be dirt cheap. It can be 2 billion also. So you need to factor this also. Any other facility, the examples that Pranay probably gave, a TSMC fab in Japan or something, they don't have the licensing fee thing, right? Because they're directly investing or they're directly putting up the fab. So this is the additional factor that you need to put in. And with all of that, it might be coming to 11 billion. And the final point is that the Powerchip chairman has said that we will give 28 and we will also help them to 22. So if indeed the agreement between Tata and Powerchip is that Powerchip will handhold them until even 22 nanometers is in production, and if this cost covers all of that, right, up to that level, then I think 11 billion is worth it. But you know, provided you know the details of their agreement has still not come out. I'm not even sure if they've worked out the nitty gritties of those agreement between both of them. But giving them that little bit of leeway there, let's hope they work out all of that.
Yeah, so this kind of brings it into like one of my fundamental questions about how we are even like building this industry. So there's this model of you have this big conglomerate like Tata working with PSMC to bring on technology transfer, and then they become a big player in the semiconductor space in India. That is one model. Then you have the second model of you basically invite some other full company to have a direct ownership of a fab here. It'll be some foreign company, and we won't have control of it, but it'll be technology here that you know our engineers can absorb. There'll be just industrial capacity being born here. When you look at China, one of the first things that they did was they invited all these companies to come, and then after some time, they've let smaller contractors learn these technologies and bring them on. Which would you say is a more sustainable way of actually creating a holistic semiconductor industry, not just one company or two companies, but a whole industry?
And I think Satvik himself in his short notes has mentioned that beyond Tata, of course Vedanta is trying, but what other who are trying to enter into the market basically? Is there any serious effort being done by other players basically?
Yeah, I'll briefly mention that also, but let me first answer Satvik's direct question. Quickly, the second model will be much more efficient, much more faster, and so on, in terms of achieving the goal of having semiconductor chips fabricated on Indian soil, right? But the first model will help in terms of the revenue that an Indian-owned company will generate in that space is possible only with the first model, right? Because a TSMC putting up a fab in India, for example, theoretically, the revenue will still be counted in Taiwan, right? I mean, if you split the global market share by revenue of where the company is headquartered, Taiwan will take that share. So that is, having said that, as a technical difference between these two, the point is that I'm pretty sure the government tried a lot for the second model, but nobody came. And why would that be? Because the top three, the TSMC, the Intel and the Samsung, they are already committed to geographies where they don't need, it's not a risk in the sense that they're already used to, whether it's Europe or US or Taiwan itself. They're all expanding in all of these geographies. So why would they really want to look at India where the readiness is much less? There is no proven, it's not a proven ground. There's no precedence. Now, who else is left? Now you have companies like GlobalFoundries or Powerchip or Tower Semiconductors who don't have the money. Even the 30% of investment that you have to take yourself and the rest 70% the government will give, these companies don't have that kind of free cash flow. So there it pretty much, quote unquote, ended. And then it became whatever comes, whatever works out. So you went with the Tata PSMC model. Having said that, at least as per the news that is coming out, the tower semiconductor proposal that is sitting right there is supposedly 100% tower owned proposal, which would fall into the second model. But then, there are probably much of inside things happening there that we don't know exactly how it's going, because it could be related to ISMC threatening to sue Tower for breach of contract and so on. And quite clearly, I don't think Tower directly has that kind of money yet. So somebody is probably backing them up, saying you first get it started and then eventually we will pay you the money or whatnot. So to the bottom line is that, or rather, let me put it this way. For me, the first fab definitely should not matter which model it follows. In other words, get it up and running. That would be the priority. And then seeing that if more companies, if somebody wants to directly invest, you're most welcome, because that will put us in a different kind of league altogether. I'm talking about if a TSMC or Samsung or Intel comes and is willing to put up their own fab there, even though it doesn't contribute directly to the Indian revenue in terms of the ownership of the company, but on Indian soil, see, you can slice and dice the semiconductor market share in various ways, right? So on the soil of that country is one way of dicing it, versus the ownership of the company is another one. So in that sense, they come in directly invest here, most welcome. I think we should encourage that also. And that also will bring, right now, Micron is such an investment, though it's for an ATM pin. I think I probably haven't answered Aditya's one part of the question, where what is the difference between the three that got approved right now compared to, let's say the Micron one. So Micron one is an ATMP, which there's a direct investment. It's not Indian owned, right? It's going to be US owned. Now you already seen one of the other companies, I forget its name, who co-located with Micron because it's a supply chain company for them. And they're also opening. Yes, thank you. So they're opening their branch in Sanand also. So this is what some of these big players will bring. Whereas for Tata Powerchip, I'm not sure. They're probably still figuring out some of these things, right? Who's going to co-locate and so on and so forth. So both models have their good points. For now, we don't have a choice. Whatever comes, we take it. Hopefully, eventually, we'll have much much better say in some of these things.
Before we move on to the
I think we have covered most of the domestic part, so we can move on to the international part.
I suspect probably Satvik or you guys will have things to tell me rather than me having to tell you. Geopolitics is not my my domain, but let's see.
I agree. So I'll tell you why we should discuss a bit about geopolitics. Is because this question is important, and I'll tell you why. So, I've been a part of certain discussions in all these tech policy conferences, and whenever any government of India guy comes, they talk about the same capacity and I would say cash flow problem and all that. And my question is, and I think I was trying to ask, is that I think let's, make it understandable to our listeners and viewers as to why is it that, which are the specific sectors where, China and Taiwan's presence when it comes to their own semiconductor influence, I would say resource capacity and all that, resourcefulness, is something which Indians must understand, right? Because this is, I think, a critical thing. The thing which I understand
for that matter, even US and Japan, what are the areas they actually excel in? And what are the areas actually at the moment US or Japan are lagging behind Taiwan or China, for instance?
How come
Japan get to do the current opening of new plant very quickly, and how come US is lagging so behind its objectives? And still it ends up recently subsidizing Intel even before it starts the TSMC plant. So it's all messed up. So that's why
because as I understand, I think consumers, automotive electronics, when it comes to EVs and autonomous driving, because EVs are becoming important for India. News keeps coming up. Indians have discovered lithium, iron, even when it comes to, ores and all. Telecom is obviously a component. I remember an interview Minister Vaishnav had, and he said that, we have built some capacity when it comes to telecom related technological components. So how does it affect that part, because for China, that's what I understand. For Taiwan, I think it's more about advanced chip manufacturing. They are very good at R&D and foundry. So, So what do you think? And I think maybe a little bit on the skill part, because the reason geopolitics matters is because this will affect our own economic capacities, right? If our IT firms and all those places, how they are going to manage the funnel, will our people who are going to be in this sector in future, will they be helped? Will our students in IIT, will they be helped? How will this go on? So I think that's where I think the geoeconomics and geopolitics matters. Bit strategic part, I think, I mean, we think you might be able to add, but, so off to you, please.
Right. So, you know, in terms of who's strong in what I would recommend is the Semiconductor Industry Association of USA, or they're probably based out of USA, maybe multiple countries members are there, but they bring out what they call as a state of the industry report every year, state of the semiconductor industry. So you should probably look at, just search for it. The latest is a 2023 or so report with data from 2022 or something like that. But there, they don't have that chart. But the previous reports, 2019, 2020, 2021, and so on, there they have a nice chart which shows the various segments of the semiconductor supply chain, for example, starting with the IP itself, to the tool makers, to the other suppliers like chemicals and gas and so on, to design. And within design itself, they have split it into logic, memory, and analog sort of split. And then it comes to wafer fabrication, packaging. And for in each of these segments, what is the percentage of strength of every country, especially US, China, Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, and so on, and others. I mean, there's the last others bucket also. And then overall, they've made and for each of these segments, they give a specific percentage of value addition in the whole supply chain, and accordingly, you have the final value addition. So over there, what you will notice is that US is still very strong in the design space. Design as in the what can be called as a fabless. Okay, thank you for showing that. I don't know which year report this is, but 2023 may not have that. Yeah, 2023 may not have that chart. I'll see if I can quickly find the older one. But I keep tweeting. I can never mind. One of the recent tweets, I have it. So now design as in fabless, right? So all these NVIDIA's and the Qualcomm's and the AMD's, right? These are all US. So there it's very still, you know, still very strong. Why the US has especially become worried is that the actual wafer fabrication percentage has gone down in US. It has gone down in Europe also. I think Europe has reached about 11% or something. US has reached about 9% or something. Taiwan used to be pretty strong there, but then China started picking up. And now it's very interesting. The 2019 or so report showed China has 16% of global wafer fabrication. And this, I would assume, is what happens on the China soil, right? These are not necessarily companies' ownership of China, but if Intel fabricates in China, that's also counted as China. And Taiwan had something like 21 or something. Now, over 2-3 years, now these guys show that China has even overtaken Taiwan. China has shown a 21% global wafer fabrication, and Taiwan has shown at 19% or something. I strongly suspect that this has an element of scaremongering from the Semiconductor Industry Association to the US government to extract money, the chips money, right? But leaving that aside, there's no, it's still true that China has grown a lot in terms of the wafer fabrication over there. But it doesn't mean that they have a monopoly or anything like that. Japan is strong in various other aspects. And I think as you were rightly pointing out, there are various kinds of chips also, right? So China focused a little bit more on the mature node chips, partly because of their inability to do some of the advanced node chips and so on. And also they are recently known to spend a lot of or give a lot of attention to compound semiconductor and so on and so forth, which are used for electric vehicles and things like that. So they've diversified. Japan's story is slightly different. They were once like in the 1980s, they were going leaps and bounds. They were giving a tough competition to US. In fact, that's when US came up with this whole Sematic idea, where they gathered a bunch of US companies and in a competition to Japan and to reduce Japan's market share, and the US succeeded in that. Ever since that, Japan went a little behind. They got stuck at around 40 nanometer. They didn't improve their, they didn't go into more advanced nodes and things like that. And that is when they woke up, and now this, you know, with COVID and things like that, they woke up. And as Satvik rightly pointed out, they were extremely fast in getting the TSMC factory up and running. Yeah, this is the chart. Thank you. Yeah, that's the tweet and that's the chart, right? So if you can, make it bigger or something, or maybe this is good enough. So it clearly shows, you can see on the top, the EDA and the core IP, the big long 72% or something is US. And then the design also, if you look at the logic, 67% or something is US. And even in analog, something like 37% or something is US. And overall design subtotal, it's still like 49% or something US. And then when it comes to equipment, you still have a 49% or something in US because Applied Materials is US and, you know, a bunch of others are also US. But then when it comes to wafer fabrication, and this thing is the one which I said is the quote-unquote the scary part, where now it shows wafer fabrication 21% China and about 19% Taiwan. So has China really overtaken Taiwan in terms of wafer fabrication? I trust not, but you know, America says so. So, but in any case, the point is China has grown big there, and you can see the big chunk in the packaging that China owns, right? So this is what became worrisome for US, as well as the fact that you know, China can compromise chips which are used in you know, military purpose and things like that. So this is where they started pushing that let's have more manufacturing on our soil. Now, having said that, in terms of the skill and all, see, what I understand is that, I mean, I had with me, you know, when I was doing my master's, some of my colleagues there in US, right, some of them who were from Taiwan, they hardly cared about what is their job situation in US after their master's. They were like, we'll go back to Taiwan and we are assured of a job there in semiconductor industry. So the kind of, you know, engineering students, whatever you learn, you do chemical in India, right? Chemical engineer, mechanical engineer, all of them ending up in a software industry. I think there's a similar situation in Taiwan, right? Whatever engineer you are, you end up in something to do with semiconductor industry is probably what Taiwan is. So, you know, that's a different story altogether. We cannot replicate that, or we don't want to replicate that also. Or for that matter, we may not necessarily want to replicate exactly the Chinese model of too many factories and, you know, brute force, pump money and make chips more than what the world needs, that kind of scenario. We have to take somewhere a middle path. Again, I go back to that the Indian way. I think, in general, Indians are very good learners. So, and especially given the fact that you have, there's no scarcity of talent, right? You have tons of engineers coming out of college, whether it is bachelor's or master's or even PhDs. It's a matter of orienting them in the right direction, getting them interested in the field, making them go beyond just academic learning of some of these things. They should start looking at the industry, learn from other sources. Don't just depend on your professor or your even books. So this is what is going to define how the talent, how the skill is going to come up in India. So the net of all of this is that we definitely have something or the other to learn from every country's strength. Say, for example, from the US, we often keep talking about 20% of the world's semiconductor design engineers are Indians or people of Indian origin. But you look at the amount of money that India makes out of these, right? All these engineers are quote-unquote being, laborers for a US company or some other company, right? So how do you make that transformation? How do you make that change from being just merely contributors to an MNC to people who actually contribute to the Indian companies or the Indian ecosystem? It's going to take time. This is where proper guidance and open discussion also many times is needed. Don't hype anything. At the same time, don't be in too much of a negative mode also. So somewhere you have to have that middle path, and you have to have a focused effort on that also. So again, how exactly you achieve it and so on, nitty-gritties, I'm not going to details of that. We can't do that in a such a short talk also. But as a first step, and I think I said this in Arihan's podcast also, please, please, please have a solid team at the India Semiconductor Mission, right? People with experience, people with industry focus. Don't put part-time folks there. Don't put just out of college folks there. Don't put bureaucrats there in charge of India's most coveted India Semiconductor Mission, right? Yeah. So let me stop there.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, one thing to also point out in this whole industry thing is that, this is, I would say the semiconductors are probably one of the most globally sensitive industries, in the sense that the cost cutting, the cost margins are very, very extreme. And that the way, like, even if you look at some of these graphs, you look at Japan, even though it may be a shrinking percentage of things, the entire semiconductor industry is very dependent on chemicals from Japan. The cleaning chemicals, the precursor chemicals, Japan has a very strong presence there. And part of this is exactly why when you see this TSMC plant getting set up in Japan, is that there was already, like in the 80s and 90s, Japan was leading the world. In fact, what the United States is being afraid about China now, they're afraid about Japan then. And that they had a lot of this had this bulk talent that was just still there. They had a lot of this still residing in Japan. And that TSMC was able to tap into that. And these industries were able to tool up very, very quickly to assist this. India is in a very different position right now because it has missed that entire thing. This needs to be built up from the ground. And when we talk about this kind of talent, we see recently, Miti announced the Future Labs effort to get industry to cooperate with the IITs, especially IIT Delhi. But you know, I think that one mistake that Indians really make when they point to these institutions is that they point to some IIT, IISc, or some other institution. This is not where the bulk of Indian engineering talent really gets made. Bulk of engineering talent happens at state colleges, state universities. These things need to be the ones that are really operationalized. One of the best universities in China, when it comes to engineering, is Harbin Institute of Technology. If you're looking at the top universities in China, you would not be able to see, this would be Tsinghua, Peking, Fudan, all these universities. You wouldn't see Harbin. But Harbin is where a lot of this engineering talent, electrical engineering talent, was really cultivated. If we in India really are actually thinking about really creating the talent for the next generation of semiconductor talent, we need to be incentivizing it across the board, not just the top level institutions. This thing really needs to be fixed.
And also electronic engineers, actually, I think, if I'm not wrong, they're mostly from those concentrated, even at state level, the courses offered are mostly, again, those two, three states only, like Tamil Nadu, Hyderabad, like Telangana and Karnataka, etc. Most of the non-state courses offered at the national level, that is what is diversified, if I'm not wrong. As far as the state colleges go, the electronics option is very much concentrated for the large part, if I'm not wrong.
Yeah, so to be a bit quote unquote fair to Miti, I believe they've said 104 institutes or something, which, you know, in theory at least, are spread across India. But then these are also mostly focused on design. I mean, you basic ideas that you give EDA for free, or and then you ask little projects, BTech projects, master's projects, come up with some product ideas and, you know, come up with the design for that and things like that. You know, well and good, but then to really get into both in terms of real products from the design perspective, as well as the fab talent, you need much more focused efforts, you need much more participation from the industry, and as rightly pointed out, you need this across the board in India, not just a couple of IITs and things like that. But yeah, let's move on to that. Let's hope, you know, as I said, at some point probably PowerChip is going to, or whoever is a partner is going to give a warning or whatnot to the Indian government and all these missions that, hey, you guys have to step up, and, you know, this, you need to really pump up the gas to get this going. So, you know, at that point, I'm sure, again, back to the reactionary mode, the government will wake up and act. Let's see.
I mean, what's the point in having national champions if they can't fund your education?
Right.
Yeah. But Arun, like, speaking of the international perspective, now the US, as you have said, it's a leader in design, still always has been. But beyond design, like, it has been quite struggling with the recent subsidies and recent objectives to have TSMC plans, right? Now, how big of a setback is it that does US has to worry that beyond design, it still has the execution issues? Because I think it has largely got to do with the local laws, DIA mandates, That is what few of the reports. I don't know how true everyone is. Like it could very much fact. It could also be like the propaganda from the other side. So there is that. But
I mean, I'll add what I know about the US side is that the when you compare the two TSMC facilities that are being set up in Japan and the US, you look at Japan. Japan's semiconductor facilities that are being set up are not modern, like are not the cutting edge. They are, I think, the 20 nanometer side. Whereas the US is trying to mandate a 7 nanometer fab. That is an order of magnitude more difficult to set up. And the fact is that Japan's approach was to start at a more legacy chip and then move up to 7 nanometers. The United States wanted 7 nanometers at the start. And that is very difficult.
But there is a bunch of reportage actually blaming US administration for the execution issues.
There are administrative issues, of course, and this is probably due to the U.S. work culture and the different kinds of like TSMC criticized that, you know, that U.S. engineers aren't willing to work, you know, 20-hour shifts or XYZ or work on the weekends. This is some work culture difference. And honestly, I think this is possibly the U.S. Not having like almost losing experience in industry and not getting used to the fact that they're not leading the world in some things anymore, and that they have to get really back into that mindset. That, you know, you look at South Korea. I think if you look back at that memory, the chart, South Korea, I think, has like 70% of the world's memory manufacturing. And you look at average South Korean work culture; it's insane. And the way that they became came from poverty to the state that they are now, it really required the grinding of their workforce, and that has really you see that there's a workforce just cultural difference, and the US just has to adapt to this.
Yeah, absolutely. You know that the work culture difference is pretty big. You know, Intel is a different story. It's not really a foundry culture. Till so far, they were bound by only their internal deadlines, whereas foundry is external facing. You are going to be under pressure from external, you know, fabless customers' deadlines. So that needs a completely different mindset and completely different culture of, you know, work culture. And these guys, TSMC, have mastered it. And they are not getting that kind of labor force that they look for from the US or from among the US citizens, right? So they have to now get a lot of their workforce from Taiwan or elsewhere. Yes, how exactly is the US handling some of these from administrative point of view and policy point of view? As an outsider, as somebody looking at it from far, many times many things are confusing to me also. I mean, I've even sometimes wondered how could the, you know, so-called world's biggest technological power have messed it up so bad. But at the same time, I'm pretty sure they will work around it and they will eventually get it right. So it could be, those things could be transitional, as in they will probably eventually stabilize. But how exactly the TSMC work culture, or, you know, the how are they going to manage it? Building is one thing, getting it up and running is one thing, but then managing it in the long term is also another thing, right? So these are things that, you know, we'll have to wait and watch how it all turns out. I mean, for all you know, maybe eventually, I'm not talking about 5 years, but 10 years, 15 years, for all you know, the TSMC facility they're building right now could be taken over by a US company. So you never know.
Yep. I had a couple
of more questions because we are running out of time, but yeah.
I know. But yeah, I think we can encapsulate that into one question if you want. That's what I was going
to
ask.
Yeah. I was basically going to ask from the strategic perspective, how much of this actually, like we have discussed TSMC cooperation with Japan, US, and I think all of this is a part of as an effort of Chips for Alliance mandate, right? Basically, that is where everything began. So where does the South Korea figure in all this? Because it is also part of this, and I have not been hearing much about the activities of South Korea in this. And second, why is NVIDIA being so buzzing at the moment compared to other semiconductor industries? Because I'm not an insider, right? So I would like to know why one company has got the limelight compared to the other. And why is it gaining so much on stocks? Is it some kind of a new technology they figured it out, new design? I have no idea, but Arun would be knowing. And especially coming back to the last part, coming back to the, again, strategic part, to the domestic part, Do you think the recent efforts of bringing PSMC and Tata thing was directly coordinated by PMO as against by Ashwini Vaishnaw? Because few reports said that this was a PMO-led initiative strategically with directly with the Taiwanese ministries. So.
Yeah, I'll answer the last question first. Yeah, I would tend to believe that it was somebody much beyond Mighty who was involved. I'll just leave it at that. Whether it was directly PMO or, I mean, it's not just the PMO, right? The government has other, you know, important people also. I think there was a brief mention of an MEA there. So, you know, connect the dots together as to who probably is a common factor between a PMO and an MEA and you know, all of that. So I would tend to believe that it's somewhere at that level that it happened. But anyway, beyond a point, it doesn't matter. It's India. You know, we've done it and we've gotten it, and let's hope that we make the best use out of it. The previous question of NVIDIA. So, I mean, it's just that, I mean, I'm not a design person, or I'm not even a person who can talk about the CPU capabilities and the GPU capabilities and compare a so-and-so chip with a so-and-so chip. But looking at it as a general knowledge or a person who has a very indirect connection to that world of the actual design and the product, many times it's certain kind of abilities that the chip has, in this particular case the AI ability and so on and so forth, that makes it click, right? And it's just that, I mean, let me put it in a slightly different example, through a different example. Intel, again going back to that, it was a leader when laptops and personal computers were the thing of the day, right? But they completely missed out on the mobile revolution. So, it was somebody else coming up and grabbing that space of the mobile revolution, be it Apple or even for that matter, Qualcomm, right? A lot of the smartphones have Qualcomm made chips. And so that was the time when Qualcomm went up. Now it's the time for all these data centers with AI capacity, AI powered or AI specific chips and so on and so forth. And so among the top five design companies, right? Qualcomm, Broadcom, NVIDIA, MediaTek, AMD. If you take these five, these are typically the ones, one of them going up, one of them going down. And these guys just probably, captured that opportunity, and it really shot up. So that's the way I see it. Whether it's long-term sustainable, whether the others will catch up or not. And by the way, these five are not the only one. I just spoke about the five biggest fabless companies. These days, it's not just fabless companies that get into these spaces, right? I mean, you have the all kinds of Amazons, and everybody wants to get into some of these things. I mean, OpenAI, all kinds of people wanting to get into the space. So we don't know what is in future, who's going to be the winner, and there's no one perpetual winner. There are winners for a certain period of time, and then somebody else comes up with other ideas and so on and so forth. So this is the way I take it. Right now they are on an upward or a bull run, if you want to call it that way. Where is it going to stabilize it? I don't know. Maybe until up until the time when somebody else gives them an equivalently capable chip and so on and so forth. We'll see. What was your first question before you brought up the NVIDIA question, Aditya?
The first question was basically the TSMC initiative for US and Japan was under, basically it was thought through, basically Chips for Alliance initiative between Taiwan, Japan, US and South
Korea. Where is South Korea?
It is missing from the headlines. That's what I was saying.
Right. So it's a strange situation. Again, maybe you guys and Satvik and all can explain how the geopolitics works out between the US. The answer might lie in where does South Korea fit in the US-China war. Right, I mean technology war. It's like, for what I understand is that for South Korea, China is like, there's a saying in Malayalam that it is too sweet that you don't want to spit it out, but it is also too sour that you don't want to swallow it. So it's some kind of that situation. They don't want to get out of China. They don't want to ditch China. It's a big market. Some of their South Korean Samsungs and SK Hynix fabs the memory superpower that South Korea is there, some of the facilities are there in China. So they are bound by that. At the same time, they cannot antagonize US because if US really pushes, they can stop the equipment supply to the SK Hynix and Samsung facilities that are in China. Moreover, Samsung is, and not just Samsung, both of them are also looking towards chips money in US. So these are all intertwined, and to make it more complicated, there is also Japan and Taiwan, right? And I believe somebody has told me that these three triangular folks, Japan, Taiwan, and South Korea, have like a love-hate relationship when it comes to China. It's more like a, you know, I mean, it's there's no like simple way to explain it. This is what I've heard from many people. Please go ahead.
Yeah, so there was a recent article talking about how SK Hynix had its semiconductor equipment that it was supposed to sell to China now just sitting in warehouses because of the US, the US bans. And this is such a major part of the relationship. But I think one thing that we don't realize is that, you know, whenever these countries do want to diversify, especially South Korea, you know, they haven't been choosing India, they've been choosing Vietnam, because Vietnam has very ready access to Chinese capital. It's in the ASEAN market. It is also seen as diversifying. Whether it really is diversifying, I disagree with it somewhat. But you know, this is Vietnam has also provided consistent electricity, and you know, it's a developed country. So there is that level to it. But there's also some kind of, I would say, some level of hesitance in South Korea, mainly because they are memory superpower. And memory is, when you compare it to other logic chips or FinFETs or MOSFETs, or that memory is actually something that, you know, is very competitive. It is something that, you know, that if you, that South Korea has a very big edge on. And, you know, the more that they try to export this kind of knowledge to other countries, the more risk that they're taking, because it is much harder than others.
Then what is all this about South Korea or Samsung helping India to do its own work in building semiconductor eco-industry?
I think as Satvik said, they are quite productive about it. And I've also heard, and maybe Satvik can throw some light on this aspect also. You know, even with Taiwan, you know, it is going to take time for both India and Taiwan to learn how to work together. There are going to be cultural differences. There are going to be, tough times of learning from both sides and everything. And I've heard that it's going to be much more tougher with South Korea, if at all we try, right? So that is, you know, probably another aspect. Long back, I had written an article saying that, look, there is always this competition of who has the, I mean, India is a big market for smartphones, right? And there's always is, you know, one of the Chinese, Xiaomi or somebody going up versus Apple versus Samsung in India in terms of who gets the best, the biggest market share of Indian smartphones and things like that. And long back, I had written an article saying that, okay, let's strike a deal. You know, we will help Samsung get a better market share of the mobile phones, and in return, you build a fab in India. But these things are, I mean, you know, probably not as easy as that. There is much bigger considerations at play here, and Samsung itself is in a tough spot in terms of their competition with TSMC, and now Intel is picking up. So their focus and their priority, I mean, if you ask them to list, give a list of 100 priorities, probably trying to put a fab in India is not even going to, you know, figure in that top 100 priorities of Samsung. So that's where it's, you know, it doesn't work out many times. Yeah. But yeah. So
and typically,
And
typically when India tries to interface with a lot of these semiconductor power countries, a lot of it does not happen at the private level, private to private. It's government to government. Recently, there was a trilateral roundtable between the U.S., India, and South Korea in Seoul. And it had like national security advisor level representation from all countries. And this is like, they talked about semiconductors, electronics, all these things. So there is like at least government interest. The real problem is getting private interest. And if you look at like the main areas, like if you look in the last couple of years, like what is the area that has received the most semiconductor investment? You know, you won't see any of these big things. It's Malaysia. Like Penang in Malaysia is what's really getting a lot of the semiconductor investment, because they've made themselves open to China, to the US, to South Korea, to everyone. So what we as Indians have like as a inherent block is that we don't have as much acceptability for Chinese money and Chinese capital. of course, there's security concerns and all these things that really, really matter. But the reality of the day is that at the end of the day, it's going to make us less competitive when it comes to ASEAN countries. So we really need to start thinking, okay, if we cannot be as cost competitive as ASEAN countries because they're connected to China, what ways in which India can provide value? And that's the thing that, you know, these companies are really going to be looking at. Countries can look at long term. Okay, the market share is going to be big. This is a big country that we can do all these things. But companies are going to be looking at what is the way. How does this affect my production costs? How does this affect my profits? What is my quarterly report really looking at if I invest in India? And India really needs to start putting the emphasis on giving these companies what is the benefit for investing in India.
Yep, absolutely. I mean, if they can capture X amount of market share in India without really sitting in India and making it in India, you know, you need to go that extra mile, whatever that you're offering to come set up a shop in India, right? So that's the bottom line.
Yeah, so do you think Samsung will do its bit in India?
Yeah, well, not an easy answer. I mean, they have their display facility somewhere in, I mean, it's basically a display assembly facility somewhere in Noida or something. So it's not as though they're completely new to this. But fab in India, I mean, from Samsung, I would say not in this decade. I mean, beyond 2030, we'll see. And much of
not in this decade. Wow.
I mean, I wish I'm wrong, right? But I really see it tough that Samsung will put up a fab in India before 2030. But let's see. All said and done, you never know. A few things, a few changes here and there. You know, they, for whatever reason, they get kicked out of China or something. Then yes, they will. But I don't see that happen as of now. But we'll see. And a lot of this is also that US has not been clear on this, right? I mean, they on the one hand they block China. On the other hand, they said okay, fine, Samsung can still get its equipment in China. So let's end also with this question. Having said all this, cooperation, quad cooperation, or India, the US wants to consider India as a or whatever, looking towards India and all. What really has US done for India in the fab space? Yeah, of course, in the packaging space, Micron, they is putting up shop in India. But beyond that, how much has US been willing to quote-unquote help India in this space, right?
I would say that there is a block here because, yeah. That if the US needs to, they're setting up fabs. First of all, the US fab expertise has been withering and they need to build up fab expertise themselves. That is why they're having all these TMC investment trying to build up fabs in the US. Because when you're looking at production scale and when you're looking at the competitiveness, like the US hasn't been competitive in the fab space for over decades. So they need to really relearn this talent. And then they would need to justify to their own citizens, okay, if we're not going to be investing it in here, why are we investing it in some other country? There is the basic ask that every politician will need to answer, every company will need to answer, like why set up there when you could set up here? So there is something to be made. There's something to be said about US-India cooperation in this fab space, but first that both countries have domestic audiences to speak to, and if this will need some high-level coordination, if not from the governments, but at least from the companies themselves. The companies need to coordinate, because when you look at Taiwan, when you look at Japan, a lot of these semiconductor companies have long-standing relationships with suppliers, with construction companies. They have understandings. They have an ideal way of they know how to create the supply chain. So when it comes to the US and India, they really need to coordinate on this front.
I don't have any more questions on my end.
Aditya, just to go back on one more point, right? I mean, again, as I said, I wish Samsung puts up a fab within the next 7 years or even earlier than that. But sometimes it also happens that the topmost in the particular space, right, might not, but you have to tap the second or the third. So maybe, especially what is with what's happening with SK Hynix in China and the US pressure and all. Perhaps SK Hynix stands a slightly better chance in the memory fab space to put up a shop in India compared to Samsung, in looking at it from that perspective. But in terms of the ability, in terms of the amount of, I mean, I think Samsung is like, they have so much cash. I believe recently there was some news about they were accumulating a lot of cash, and there was a lot of talk about who are they going to acquire. So these guys have, cash is not a problem for them. So in that perspective, Samsung has a much better probability. But eventually, all of this depends on so many other factors, including how they're doing. It's right now an upcycle for memory, but then it is just coming out of a pretty bad downcycle 1 or 2 years back. So many of these considerations, and you know, it's not an easy answer. From India's side, we should keep trying. Let's not stop at one. Let's not overdo it also, but at the same time, let's not just stop at one. We definitely need two or three and a little bit variety, like the power chip one. Tata power chip one is most likely going to be focused more on, as the name suggests, power chips, high voltage chips, and so on. We do need a tower like fab which can focus more on the communication analog chips kind of space. Eventually we need somebody who can focus more on the logic and more advanced nodes, which maybe the Tata, one of these fabs itself, can move to the more advanced nodes eventually. And we do eventually also need memory kind of fabs. So you know, at least 3 or 4 or 5 have scope within the next decade or so. So let's keep trying. We never know which one will click or not.
Yeah, and hopefully it's not too late until then. But Abhi, Satvik, I am done with the questions on my end. Please, you both want to wrap it up with any other questions?
Well, to be very fair, I think I'm also kind of done, because a lot of things that I was going to ask, I think Arun has already addressed. I'll be honest. But yeah. I think the takeaway which I like the most is that Samsung might not be able to do it until 2030, but let's do. You know, a lot
of people, if it were a news medium, that would have been the headline, not the rest of the discussion.
I didn't say it as a quotable quote. I just said it. See, sometimes you say things where deep within your heart you hope that what I'm saying eventually turns out to be wrong, right? So it's one such statement where I don't want to put my hope for the next 7 years or next 6 years, right? Yeah. But if it happened, right, I guess
there's like one thing that I'd want to say to the whole space, the whole tech space in India, is that do not celebrate until there is a chip being made in India. That is when you get to celebrate. Don't celebrate before.
Absolutely. A chip being fabricated and made in India, not the Ashwini Vaishnav packaged and made in India. Sorry to say that, but yeah.
If somebody's listening, please listen. But anyways.
Yeah, fabricate, package, and that's real made in India chips. I mean, if it's designed also and owned in India, great, that's even the next step. But at least fabricate the chip in India in high volume and then claim that we have made it in India. Anyways,
Arun, I think then if Satvik and Abhivardhan doesn't have anything else to add, that was a really, really solid 1.5 year. It was a jam-packed discussion. We pretty much covered all the major bases, from definition and the basics of semiconductor industry to the world implications, etc., etc. So that was a pretty 360 degrees holistic discussion. Abhivardhan, can you inform the listeners and viewers where can they actually listen to this?
Sure. And one thing to add, I think we have been properly doing the YouTube live on StreamYard, I think nearly after a year. I'll be very honest. I think the last one we did was with Soleiman or Sana. But I think this one is like literally after a year. And we really are thankful to the viewers and listeners who came live. Around 200. Thank you so much. There will be more in, you know, who will be being watching this. But thank you so much for your love and support. May we have these discussions on various aspects. And yeah, I think it was a great discussion. So everyone can go to bharatpacific.com. On Spotify, you can also search Deep Bharat Pacific on YouTube, since you're on YouTube. So yeah, go there, Spotify, YouTube, and our website, and yeah, find out what we discuss a lot of things, apart from geopolitics, of course. So yeah, it's been fun.
Yeah, if you can wait for 1 minute, I think, Abhi, can you end the live part first?
Sure.
Thank you guys. Thank you all. We need much more people in getting. We need to first get a lot of people interested in this whole topic, and then you know, out of that, some will pick it up and some will go much ahead, and you know, some will hopefully become real leaders in the space a few decades down the line.
Completely agreed.